Okie dokie. So we're all go. And welcome everybody to our Sunday class. We're doing the six perfections based on the Lam Rim Chenmo. So make yourself comfortable in your seat. This means sort of making sure that your back is straight and your shoulders relaxed. And then while you breathe normally and naturally, become aware of the movements that take place in the upper chest and the lower abdomen. While you continue breathing normally and naturally. And while you're breathing normally and naturally, imagine that the spiritual families of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas arrive from the 10 directions and are present in the space above you. And that every sentient being is seated surrounding you. And every one of them is related to you as a parent, as an uncle or aunt, a brother or sister or child. And throughout your ever-changing relationships, your happiness is always dependent upon their kindness. And while they too are wished to be happy, and equally to avoid suffering, every one of them has never been genuinely happy. But now that the auspicious causes and conditions are present, form the resolve to quickly attain for them enlightenment. And by doing so, help them turn their mind to the truth. To practice that truth as a path, to remove obstacles from their path, and to purify their confusion into wisdom, thereby revealing their natural birthright, a state of unchanging goodness. And for this to come about, we're going to take refuge in the families of the enlightened beings, generate the mind of enlightenment, and say the preliminary prayers and make offerings. So let's begin by taking refuge and generating the mind of enlightenment. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly by my practice of giving and other perfections. May I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So now, stabilizing this wish and enhancing it, we recite the four immeasurables together. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. So accomplishing the path means we need to accumulate the necessary merit to do so, and purify the mind of everything that hinders us. The practices of accumulation and purification are all contained within the seven limb prayer, so we'll recite that together. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. Now, probably the greatest obstacle for us is the clinging that we have to our body, to what we say and to what we think, and also to the merit that we create. So here we're going to make an offering of a mandala, and in the offering of that, imagine that your clinging completely vanishes. In the absence of that clinging, a wonderful pure land appears, whereby all sentient beings can take teachings from you as an enlightened being. So this ground, anointed with perfume and strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kam Niryatayami. So the offering is accepted by the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in front of us, and they smile at us with delight. Then the families of enlightened beings begin to dissolve into light, which melts into the central figure of Shakyamuni Buddha. It begins to decrease in size, and then move through space to abide above the crown of your head, facing in the same direction you are. Then he descends through space, entering the crown of your head, and then comes to rest at the level of your heart, whereby once again his radiance increases and the light fills your body and mind completely. The rays of light go out further, out from the pores of your skin, filling all 10 directions of space. And wherever there are living beings within space, they are touched by that light and transformed into fully awakened beings. And from the body of each of those enlightened beings, light rays go out into the 10 directions of space. And you rest in this light, breathing normally and naturally. Our light begins to withdraw from the 10 directions of space and once again enters your body at the level of the heart. You breathe normally and naturally with the knowledge that the deepest nature of your mind is no different from the ultimate nature of the mind of a fully awakened being. As this is so, you're going to develop that potential to fully awaken by engaging in studies like this, putting what you understand into practice, and bringing about your own welfare and the welfare of every other living being. Now breathing in deeply through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, and bring your attention to your seat and to the screen in front of you. I guess I'll begin the class now. As you can see, we're up to class 7. And so far, our learnings have been based around the six perfections, but in particular the perfection of generosity. And these are some of the different things we've looked at. We've looked at some of the obstacles and antidotes to generosity, or the perfection of, what is Lama Zopa called now? We've got generosity and charity. How to begin the development of charity and the divisions within generosity. So motivations to be adopted, motivations to be abandoned, and we're really looking at the motive, how to give. So remember, here, perfection, the word for perfection in Sanskrit is paramita, and it means going beyond the end or reaching perfection. And in general, there are 10 perfections, but they've been condensed into six. And the major obstacle for practicing generosity is what they call miserliness or stinginess. Physical generosity is the giving of the material or physical substances. But the most important thing about generosity is the mental attitude that you take up when you give things away. So the perfection of generosity is really centered around the attitude that we develop when we make charity to other things. And I've been relying upon these particular books, in particular, The Great Treatise on the Stages of the Path to Enlightenment. That's the one on the bottom here by Lama Tsongkhapa. But I've also been calling upon, in terms of commentary, Geshe Sopa's work and Geshe Tashi Tsering's work. And whenever necessary, if I find something interesting that's not covered by Lama Tsongkhapa or Geshe Tashi Tsering or Geshe Sopa, I'll put that material in also. And so that's why I have these other books as well. So we are presently in a section called Things to Give. And here today, we're going to be looking at a brief and a detailed presentation of the things to give. But today, we're really focusing on more of a look, I think it's what not to give. And what learning about what not to give shows us what to give. And we're focusing here on how not to give the inner things. So, Geshe Sopa said, in general, whatever we give should bring pleasure at present, be free from the causes for lower rebirth, and result in the happiness of a higher rebirth. So, and in the long run, these things should bring about the ultimate positive result by helping the recipients eliminate unskillful actions and leading them to create virtue. Therefore, both from the short and long-term perspective, the things we give should be meritorious. So we use the word meritorious. The merit is relating to either higher realm rebirths or liberation or enlightenment. Merit is really to do with spiritual attainments. So, like I said, is a very brief presentation first, so we'll run for that. And it's made up of these things called things not to be given and those things to be given. And we're going to sum it up very quickly by looking at this. So, things that should not be given are things that are harmful at present and bring harm in the future. Those things that should be given might be harmful at present, but not in the future. So, for instance, wise parents, will know when they notice that their child is sick, for instance, and that they might have to give them medicines, and the medicine the child doesn't like it. It perhaps tastes funny. Just like when we were growing up, sometimes we had medicine that didn't taste very nice. We didn't like it, but our parents knew that in the long run, it helped us. So we have to know what to give and what not to give, because actually both can be forms of generosity. Isn't that interesting? Not giving something is a form of generosity. So something else that should not be given is something that is pleasant in the present and harmful in the future. So here we have a lot of sweeties and foods that are lots of fats in them and things like this. So it's a very simple, picture. Perhaps you can think of some other things that might be pleasant in the present but harmful in the future.
Well, the whole opioid epidemic is like that, isn't it? All those people given painkillers and then getting addicted to them.
Yeah, that's right. So, yep. And finally, in the other side, to be given those things that are pleasant in the present and in the future. So, if anybody think of something that might be pleasant in the present and be pleasant in the future.
If we can't think of this, we're in trouble. No one said anything.
Giving, either making donations to charities or giving a meal to someone, just general basic, generosity with the right attitude.
Yeah, that's right. That's a very simple one, and this is something we can do. And it's very good that you said that one, Dalma, seeing we are focused around generosity. So giving meals at any time in our present life right now, it could bring about, for us at least, the perfection of generosity. And also for the other person, it feeds them the present and it's helpful for them in the future.
Eddie, so Metta's said giving Dharma practice,
Yes,
and
that's
Ian
right.
has
That's the
said
other.
giving meditation.
Yeah, giving the practice of, that's right, helping people learn how to discipline their minds is very, can be very pleasant in the present and also in the future. Once again, so Geshe Sopa says, now wise parents do not let their children have too many sweets in the afternoon because they will feel ill in the evening. In this case, the wise parents are giving their children protection. So the very act of not giving can be a form of generosity. Now, so I think this is very pertinent in the times we live, especially with the different types of foods. And it could even be like, come around Christmas time, you'll see so many kiddies wanting whatever they see in the supermarkets and the toy shops.
Yeah,
And many of us will immediately try to, stop their what looks to us as suffering in the present. Are you going to say something before?
I was just thinking about the addiction also to screen time and, pleasant being, playing
Yeah.
computer games for hours and hours and hours, pleasant in the present but harmful in the future.
Yeah. So it's again, Geshe Sopa says we can give something that is temporarily unpleasant, but ultimately brings blissful happiness. And if this is like a physician giving a patient an injection, it might be painful, but the long-term result is helpful. Now we're going to have a look at some other presentations now. So in terms of the detailed explanation, we're going to be focusing around two things. Those things that are internal and those things that are external. And the internal things are really focused upon the body. So here we have all these internal things of the body, but it also means the arms, the legs, you know, the whole body and the parts of the body. These are called the internal things that one can give. And then there are the external things. And this topic really has got two subdivisions. So we talk about the internal things that are and are not to be given. And the same thing for the external things that are and are not to be given. And the internal, of course, refers to one's body, whereas the external refers to one's belongings, food, shelter, and so on. So internal is in the continuum of the body, the external is not. So we're going to look first at some of the inappropriate internal things. And here we've got from different viewpoints that we can take. So the first is from the viewpoint of time. Second is the purpose. And thirdly, from the one who asks. So a bodhisattva can practice generosity by giving his or her body or life. So this includes giving a single organ or one's entire body. So we're asking here, you know, when should it be done? How is it done? Why should it be done? So then Amasong Kappa says, you know, if we understand when it is not suitable, we will know when and how it is suitable. So first of all, we're going to look at the things, these things are not permitted in these sort of subsections. So when it says, for the one who asks is inappropriate giving from the viewpoint of the one who asks for something. So Arya Shantideva said, until the thought of compassion is completely pure, you should not give your body. In general, in this and other lives, you give to accomplish the great purpose. So in the beginning, practitioners need to develop compassion and love. So I'd say, you know, we are beginners. We probably don't actually have an authentic mind of enlightenment, but we wish to become, you know, at least we have that on our mind stream. I think we see the great benefit of becoming enlightened for the benefit of others. Yet we'll have some compassion and we'll have some love. This will need to be strengthened. So it's only when the bodhisattva has a pure and great compassion, can they and should they give their body as part of the practice of generosity. For example, in one of the Buddha's past lives, he was able to offer his body to a starving tigress. So some of you might remember when we do the Buddha, the puja for Shakyamuni Buddha, there's a story in there, it comes up a number of times, where taking from the Jataka tales, where the Buddha, as a young prince with his brothers in the forest, came across a starving tiger.
It's also in the Sutra of Golden Light.
Okay, it's also the Sutra of Golden Light. And the prince opens his veins and puts his arm near to the starving tigress so she can lick his blood and then devour him and feed her cubs. And in the Sutra of Golden Light, isn't there, there's this great section where the mother realizes that her son has died. And the king and the queen and the ministers go into the forest looking for him. And basically just find his bones all scattered about. And the mother's really upset about it. So there is that story of the Buddha as a bodhisattva offering his body to the starving tigress. You've got to remember here, at that time, he had already reached a high bodhisattva level. And he had no attachment to his body. So having no attachment, he could freely give us flesh and bones as easily as we could give a vegetable to a beggar. So when one's attitude towards one's body is that it is just food, like a vegetable, then they don't have any difficulty in giving it away. And remember I said last week, and you know, I'm trying to encourage you to think or to remember the real essential points of this practice, which is that all beings are teachers to us, and the other is that what we have belongs to others. So if we could just sort of keep trying to hold on to those two thoughts, but then be skillful in how we rely on others as teachers and return what belongs to others. So Geshe Sopa says, we can become accustomed to generosity gradually. We should try to give whatever we can. In the beginning, it might be as little as a mouthful of food. After a while, our stinginess will lessen and we will want to help others more and more. After long practice, when our generosity has become very advanced, we will be able to offer our flesh, like the bodhisattvas or the Buddhas in the stories.
Eddie, Carolyn's also put that donating blood and plasma is a wonderful thing that we can actually do now safely with the Red Cross right now with our body, which is really quite extraordinary when you think of it.
Yeah, so Carolyn's quite right. So when we go and do this now, like, make it the perfection of giving, the perfection of generosity. You know, try not to forget the mental attitude to bring in to the doctor's office when you offer blood or plasma. You know, so it becomes more than just giving blood. It becomes the perfection of giving. And it's a lovely, it's like a beginning, isn't it? We're able to give part of our body away like that. So we're now going to look at the viewpoint of time. So I guess what I wanted you to take away from here is do what you can enjoy and feel good about afterwards. Like, for instance, when we see on television, or there's oftentimes comes when they ask for blood to be given, for donors of blood. So when that comes up and we can actually do this, allow enjoyment to come up, appear in your mind, and then feel really good about doing it afterwards, of course. And this will come about if you can recollect the bodhisattva attitude to adopt when you're about to give blood and when you are giving blood and afterwards. So from the moment of taking the bodhisattva vow, a bodhisattva dedicates his or her body, wealth and merits to others. So, should a bodhisattva give his or her body whenever it is requested? Now, although they have mentally given these things, which is what we should do too, mentally give them, it does not mean that beginner bodhisattvas must physically give them right away. Giving freely and entirely does not mean giving everything all at once. You have to be judicious. For example, parents wish to give everything possible to their children, but they hold some things back because the children may not be able to use certain things safely until they are older. Bodhisattvas give like good parents who establish a trust fund for their children. The money and trust belongs to the children. However, they cannot have it right away, even though they might want it. Children need to be protected until they reach a certain stage of development. A beginner bodhisattva who has not directly realized emptiness must be careful not to do too much at the start. Before reaching the first Arya level, meaning the path of seeing, we could experience problems if we were required to give whatever was asked of us. Until one has fully ripened compassion and a realization of the true nature of reality, one's spiritual strength is undeveloped and one's perseverance is weak. In the beginning, we should do only as much as we can do comfortably. Just do what you can, enjoy, and feel good about it afterwards. It is immature to take on too heavy a task for too long a time. This will cause us to make mistakes, to do things incorrectly, and feel great regret afterwards. In the long run, it can make one give up accumulating the merit to attain complete enlightenment. And this would be enormously harmful to other sentient beings, in addition to oneself. So do you guys remember there's another story about, just forget the guy's name. So here's a bodhisattva, he actually had the mind of enlightenment, but he didn't have the realization of emptiness. And he went looking for his teacher for years. And finally found where the teacher was. He went there, but the teacher was at a long retreat and wouldn't come out of the retreat. And this bodhisattva just, really hanging out, really wanted to meet his master, was just hearing his name instilled, this great faith in him. So he wanted to make an offering to his master, but he had nothing to give. So he went down to the market and sold a piece of his flesh from his thigh and took that and all the blood that he was collected and then made this offering of a mandala of dropping all the blood in the sand to make the, and of course it was incredibly painful for him because he had no realization of emptiness. And he sort of fell down exhausted after doing this. And then he had a dream, and in the dream, Avalokiteshvara appeared and placed his hand on the wound. And then when he woke up from the dream, the wound had healed and he had no pain in his leg. And then shortly after, his master came out of retreat to help him realize the perfection of wisdom.
That's an amazing story, Eddie.
Yeah, it's a great story, eh? That's also, I think, in perhaps the Sutra of Golden Light. So, from the viewpoint of time, is it? In other words, for people like ourselves, I know we admire the mind of enlightenment. We are trying to do the best that we can do. And sometimes it might be that we do too much. We think we can do something, we just get sort of carried away a little bit. And then we find that we can't do what we thought we could do. And then we could become discouraged. So he's saying, try not to have that happen to you. And if you do become discouraged, what would you do? Any ideas?
Call a friend.
I'm sorry, who is that?
A friend. Call a Dharma friend.
Yep, that's something you could definitely do. Take a step back, and what do we do in the step back? That was Rosemary, wasn't it? So we could take a step back, we could call a friend, we could re-establish our motivation. Can you think of anything that could actually re-enhance the mind of enlightenment? So we're sort of...
Of compassion?
Yep, that's true. But how? What would we do?
Retake your bodhisattva vows.
Yep, we could retake the vow. Anything else? Can anybody think of anything else? So here we're feeling discouraged. We try to do something to help someone with this, the attitude of developing the perfections. It didn't work out. We're a little tired, we're a little discouraged now.
Maybe meditate on it and look at it from a different viewpoint.
Yep, that's what I'm trying to, lead people here, that's right.
Seeing yourself as being in samsara, the same as everybody else.
Yep.
Having compassion for yourself because you're in samsara, everyone else is samsara, everyone's suffering.
Yep, so now I'm going to ask, what can we do with this feeling of compassion for ourselves? That we can actually enhance the mind of enlightenment again.
Just remembering that you have to become enlightened, otherwise you can't escape. There's no way of changing samsara. But,
what I'm trying to get at here is suggest that you do the giving and taking meditation.
Okay, yep.
Straight away. I mean, that's the wonderful thing about anything that you find discouraging, it can be taken on the path immediately. You already feel it. You know, lots of other people become discouraged. It's great. You've already got it. May the sack is a foundation to bring about, you know, the freedom from self-cherishing and all beings be free of it. And just breathe it out. So, you know, I just suggest that because so much of the mind of enlightenment, the development of it, is based around being able to do Tonglin practice. And like you can take everything and make it a path. You know, when it's good, we give it away. When it's bad, we place it on self-cherishing. So we continually build and strengthen the mind of enlightenment in this way. That's just what I was trying to lead you to, sort of. Slightly.
Just the thing of remembering to do it, Eddie, that's so difficult, because we can take everything onto the path. This is fantastic. But when you're in the thick of being discouraged, it's the last thing you think of to do.
Yeah. So that's true. So what we've got to actually acknowledge is that we are discouraged. You know, well, we are. But then to use it. So. It's not to try and we shouldn't be trying to like put it off to the side or anything like that. Like I said, it can be used. It's fuel. And in this part of the we're in the great scope now. We're training in the great scope. So we've got to bring in our knowledge of the lower scopes of karma and suffering and compassion and so forth, self-compassion. But then we want to do more than that. We use that as a basis or a ground for a development of the mind of enlightenment, of greater compassion and greater loving kindness. So we take it on and think, oh, this is what all beings suffer. Now may this be the foundation or a basis where I can place the sufferings of all beings who become discouraged. And may they be free of it. And then we breathe it out and bring a sense of so what do you think what would you like to replace discouragement with? Anyone?
Courage.
I was gonna say like courage, encouragement, isn't it? Courage and encouragement.
Joyous effort.
Sorry, more joy.
Joyous effort.
Yeah. To become, yes, it's hard to become a bodhisattva, but we are engaged in it. That's a great thing. It's a tremendous thing. To have more confidence, to have confidence.
Carolyn says that having this class worked against her discouragement this morning.
Wonderful.
Rosemary says, confidence in your refuge.
Yeah, that's right. So, it's a great thing to say, Rosemary, because it's an undisciplined mind that brings about our suffering. It's a disciplined mind that reminds that the mind is actually, it could be a source of refuge for us. It's the undisciplined mind that creates all the suffering. It's a disciplined mind that brings about the happiness. And it's a disciplined mind that is our refuge. So we've got to discipline ourselves, and that means we've got to recollect what we know and do it. That's the sort of discipline. Don't forget, remember, and do it. Anyway, thank you, everyone, for what you've added for engaging in our little discussion like this. So I'll go back now and we'll continue with the presentation. So now we come to the next slide. Oopsie. So Arya Shanti Deva says, in the beginning, the great teacher, meaning Buddha, encourages the giving of such things as food. Later, when accustomed to this, you may progress through giving away your own flesh. And at such a time when my mind is developed to the point of regarding my body like food, then what hardship would there be when it comes to giving away my flesh? So we should do everything possible to lessen our attachment and increase our generosity and compassion for others. I was thinking, like, when we die, our body is food, isn't it? Mm. You know, I hear sort of say, we're trying to have this idea, it's always been food. I've offered it to all sentient beings because it doesn't belong to me. It's just taken on loan to bring about their welfare. And, like I said, you get put in the ground. If you're not burnt, then it becomes food. So all suffering comes from a self-centered attitude. If we do not eliminate selfishness, there is no way to be free from suffering. And attachment also increases hatred. Until we drop our self-interested pursuits, we are holding on to the source of pain. If we do not let go of a burning torch, we will get burned. And the practice of generosity is actually targeting selfishness. You must probably remember the story of that very selfish person who found it really, really difficult to give. And the Buddha was at his house and was trying to help him. So he just, he took something that the man already had, which was an orange. And he put it in his right hand. And he said, so this is in the right hand. Now just try and give it to the left hand. And this fellow didn't even want to do that. He had that little, it won't be in my right hand if I give it in the left. Anyway, he finally was able to put it in the left. So how does that feel? In the left hand. Would you like to put it back in the right hand? Would you like to give it to the right hand? So he started doing this. So the man was quite comfortable just taking one thing and putting it in the other hand. Then he was able to take this thing and then gradually give it to his closest friends, his wife, his children. Gradually wear away at the clinging, the sort of stinginess, all arising out of attachment. So basically we too can free ourselves from attachment. Gradually, one's property and even one's life can become of service to others.
Jeanette also says about look how we react when a mosquito wants a drop of blood from us.
Yeah, that's right. And then comparing that to how Lama Zopa reacted when the mosquitoes come. And he took off his robe and just lay down and offered his back to all the mosquitoes. So it's gradually, and we're all people with different mental capacities. So, for some of us, we might be able to, instead of just swatting the mosquito or driving away, might allow them to have, a little bit of blood, and then we can, that's enough, that's all I can bear. So gradually. Same sort of things when all the ants come, and don't they? And they're all looking for shelter or sugar. We can be generous and offer them, a portion of the bench or a little bit of sugar, or we can even take the sugar outside. You have to be sort of skillful in this. Geshe Sopa goes on and says that gradually one's property and even one's life can become of service to others. So many of us will share our Dharma books with others, Many of us will give Dharma books or buy books about Dharma and give them away to others who are not Buddhists. You know, we're practicing generosity, bringing to them the Dharma in a way that's sort of non-threatening.
Eddie, in fact, lots of people do that, buy the same Dharma book like 5 or 6 times because they keep on giving it away.
Yeah, well, that's right, especially if you find a really very good book that you understand and has made a difference in your own life, that's exactly the sort of book to give away. But to do this, you've got to sort of strongly feel what Geshe-la said, the dearness of others, that others are dear to you. Then we have no problem at all giving away books, clothing, our material possessions. And finally, like I said, we could even give away our body to them. So we know a family whose son, was it a kidney that the mother gave to the son, Dave and Pearl?
Yeah, that's right. Yep, Dave's mum gave her grown-up son a kidney.
Yeah, and that's because she holds Dave dearly. And so we know it gets done in this life. I'm sure anyone here who's has a child or somebody else that they hold dear, if that person needed part of your body that you could give, you would. So we can do it. We often do it to those closest, and we need to start there.
It's okay to start with those closest to us. I somehow thought that was kind of cheating.
If you can't do it to those close, I really don't know how you'll be able to do it effortlessly towards those distant. Yeah. And this has really come about because you hold them dearly. You know, so of course those closest to us, we hold them dearly and there's attachment involved. That's true. But nevertheless, it's still the giving. And we can use that as a starting point. Once again, so these instructions can be practiced in daily life. Desiring to share one's body and one's belongings in order to benefit others is the result of correct practice. Enjoyment of generosity shows we're going in the right direction. We should enjoy giving. So now from the viewpoint of purpose. So he says, it's not good to give parts of your body or your body to others for an insignificant reason. The body can be used to practice the holy Dharma and thereby help many other beings. In that sense, the body is like a wish-granting jewel. If we use it to attain enlightenment, we will quickly fulfill the wishes of all sentient beings. And that's far more worthwhile than giving up one's life for one person for some trivial reason. So we need to carefully examine our motivation all the time. Now, the main reason we do not practice generosity is stinginess. That's funny, the first time I heard this word, stingy, I think I must have heard it when I was a kid, but that's about it. And then one day, Geshe-la used the word stingy. I thought, wow, I've been a long time. So stinginess works against generosity. So a bodhisattva does not have an unwillingness to share. He or she determines whether giving will be helpful to others or not. So that's what you need to ask yourself. Each of us has to ask ourselves if what we intend to do, what we intend to give, will fulfill the wishes of all sentient beings or just one. So remember here, we're talking about internal offerings, meaning the body and its parts. So carefully examine your motivation. Okay, so look, we've got only one more slide to come up. So let's, it's what, 8 minutes to 11? Let's take a 10-minute break and you guys making another cup of tea or late breakfast or go to the loo, and we'll see you just after 11. So before that, I want to dedicate for you and I and all beings that we might engage in the practices of the perfections and accomplish them for the benefit of those who are unenlightened. Now, welcome back, everyone. Good to see you all. Let's do this next slide, and then we can have a little chat. So this is the old one. So we need to carefully examine our motivation before giving. And then this last one is from the viewpoint of one who asks. So I particularly put this picture up so that it would trigger something off in your mind. So we're here. So this topic is about when not to give the body from the point of view of time, purpose, and from the point of view of one who asks for something. And so we're up to this one, the viewpoint of one who asks. So Harry, we should not give something if it would harm ourselves or others. So Geshe Sapa says, there are evil spirits who are always looking to do harm. They injure others for their own enjoyment. Some sentient beings may be under the sway of these demonic forces. In that case, a bodhisattva should not accede to their request for his or her body or life. Does anyone remember the story? I think it was a story of Shariputra. So he had entered the bodhisattva path. He must have been at the path of accumulation. The path of accumulation is made up of three parts. The first is called earth-like bodhicitta, whereby you can actually lose the mind of enlightenment. The second part is called gold-like bodhicitta, where it's impossible to lose it. So Shariputra was, approached by a teacher in a forest that wanted one of his hands, you know. So he wanted Shariputra's right hand. So then Shariputra had to cut his right hand, which he did. He took off his right hand, and then he passed it to that fellow with his left hand. But in Indian culture, your left hand is used for wiping your bottom. Right, so it's really a really bad, bad thing to sort of be giving with the left hand, or to eat food with the left hand. So when he offered his right hand with his left hand, this person said, "Oh, that's really disrespectful. How could you do something like that? Yeah, I can't. That's blah, blah, blah." And Shariputra was so dismayed by this. Sentient beings, they just can't help him. And dropped the bodhisattva attitude. Right? Later on, of course, he became an arahat, but not a bodhisattva arahat. So, you know, whether that actually happened or not, I think it really demonstrates how difficult it is to benefit others and to keep hold of this intention to do so, you know, to become enlightened and go through all these difficulties for the sake of another. And so this is the one where Bob is saying, you know, this is a sort of request you should not accede to. So it's also pointing, I think, about how important intelligence is. And even more than this, like wisdom. You don't really know, do you? Does the person really need my arm? You have this great compassion, great kindness, so you do it, and then they find actually it's not just an ordinary person. This is a person under the control of demonic forces. He's just out there to screw you over. So this is, even though a bodhisattva does not worry about his or her own suffering, giving in such a situation would only enable the requesters to harm themselves. Those other beings have already created negative karma. If we allow them to kill us, they will create even more negative karma. Similarly, we should not give our life to the insane or the mentally disturbed if they ask for it, because they are not requesting from their heart. Their words are just gibberish. Not giving in these situations is not breaking the bodhisattva vows. In fact, it would be wrong to give in these situations from the point of view of time, purpose, and the requester.
So if you're getting mugged by someone that was, you know, crazed off their mind, then, you know, not just giving them everything, it wouldn't be breaking the vow. You could do something else to try and help them.
Yeah, that's right. So we need to be like, you know, I mean, the whole purpose of this teaching today is to sort of, you know, got this great summary how what we're talking about giving the body or the parts of the body, and knowing that inappropriate is the wrong time to do that. If the purpose is not right, we shouldn't do it. And also, if the person is requesting of us our body, we know that they're going to put it to a harmful purpose, and we should not do it either. You know, because it doesn't do any good for them. We are concerned about their welfare. We cannot give the body when we know they're going to use it for harmful purposes. So he finishes off by saying there are two aspects to giving away one's body or life. The first involves giving part now and part later. For example, giving blood at various times during the year. Just remember that whatever and whenever you give, it is permanently given. Now, the second involves temporarily giving others power over one's body to accomplish a religious purpose. You know, an example would be going to work as a servant in a monastery or a convent. Now, so it's, you know, it's wrong, it would not be right to give our body when it enables the requesters to harm themselves. So now I'm going to go back to this, the other screen share. We'll come back again when we summarize. But I just want to ask you guys a few things and see what you think.
So, Eddie, with that picture of the slide of the, your country, can you say something about that?
Okay. So what do you think I'm trying to draw to your attention when I put that picture up of Lord Kitchener? You guys know, you probably know who Lord Kitchener is, don't you?
Wasn't that a request for people to volunteer to fight in the war?
That's right. That's right, Ian. So, you know, they lose those huge posters and Lord Kitchener's going like, your country needs you. So what he was trying to do was encourage the subscription rate of young men and women to go to war to fight for the British Empire. Yeah. So, yeah, there are a lot of young men who go off and offer their body up for their country. But if you ask, them, like, why are you doing that? You'd probably get a wide variety of answers, wouldn't you?
Yeah, well, if you were a young man from an outback Australian town, you'd be going off because everybody else is and it's a great big adventure. I mean, there's so many young men just rushed to join up.
Are you in agreement, Kate, or disagreement?
I think in the First World War, a lot of it was a social obligation.
Well, made it so, didn't they? They also had those stories of the women who'd give the young men the white flower, didn't they?
As feather, like with, feather. With
a feather, that's right. So you were a coward if you didn't go. But see here, imagine if you were a young man at those times and you knew about the bodhisattva attitude. So would it be correct then, you think, to give your body to the government to go overseas and take the lives of other young people? Probably not, eh?
No, probably not.
You'd have to just go as a medic or something like that.
Yeah.
Yes, well, there's that wonderful story, wasn't it, Miffy, about that young fellow who did that, went as a medic in the Second World War and saved the Japanese lives as well as the American lives.
And also
he would not fire a rifle.
Yeah, refused to carry a rifle and the whole time, enlisted and as a pacifist and refused to have a rifle.
Yeah. So can you think of anything like us? So that was the simple one. Why I put that Lord Kitchener up there to, you know, sort of go, oh, this is right. These people are asking me for my body to go to take the lives of other people. Because that's what you're sort of, you know, a lot of military service, you are trained to take life. Many people are or to contribute to the taking of lives. And it can be quite distressing. So that's, what's an easy sort of one for the men and young women who wish to join the armed forces. Can you think of other instances for women, for instance? You're going to give your body. Yep, that's right, Caroline. Yep.
So this is what we were talking about in the break, because I'm a fan of watching Botched on TV, and so lots of young women will get a boob job for their husbands, but they'll go get it as a cheapie down in Mexico, you know, which of course ends up in just like catastrophe and hundreds of thousands of dollars of just of botched surgery and an unhappy wife and an unhappy husband. Mm. But it's prevalent enough to make a TV show about it.
Yeah. And then you also mentioned, didn't we, about how sometimes parents will give their daughters enough money to have a nose surgery or breast surgery as a sort of a present when they reach a certain age.
Yeah, as a sweet 16 present.
So we don't meet that criteria. I think we're all a bit older than 16.
There's a situation overseas which affects both women and men, not in Australia, but if there was the criminal system had a death penalty, and you're on the jury and you found someone guilty, you would be getting someone perhaps to get killed.
Yes, so that's like anti-generosity, isn't it? You're offering death.
Yeah, so one of the things here was of about that, wasn't it? Even like to not do something can be seen as an act of generosity.
Eddie, can I ask you something?
Sure,
I always wonder about the guards that guard His Holiness. Mm-hmm. They carry semi-automatic guns.
Yeah.
I wonder how the Dalai Lama feels about that. They are there to protect him. They are there probably to give their lives to protect him.
Yeah.
So how does that fit in with being a bodhisattva? That he has them there to protect him?
Yep, so I think if they had the bodhisattva attitude, it wouldn't be a problem. the guards, but I doubt they do.
Yeah, because I always remember seeing a picture of His Holiness and he was walking along the path, must have been where he lives, and there was a guard with the gun.
Yeah.
And His Holiness stopped and just patted. I think it was the, I can't remember now if it was the guard or the gun that he patted on his way past. It's always made me wonder.
You wonder what is the guard, because I think the photo is like he's going like this with the guard.
Yeah, I've got the photo on my album because it really struck a chord with me. I just thought it was amazing. I thought, what does he think when he sees that guard with the gun?
Well, I think from the ordinary perspective is, well, that person's there to protect me.
Mm-hmm.
And that person has a gun, but he's also, you have any of those people in the armed forces are willing to put their lives at stake, aren't they? That's what happens if you join the armed forces. That's what's going on. So it means you're also willing to lose your life or take a life.
Yeah, but how from a point of view of how His Holiness thinks?
Well, wouldn't he be doing like spontaneous Tonglen?
I don't know, Miffy. It's just always perplexed me, that picture. Every time I think about it, I think, imagine what he's thinking as he walks past that guard with the gun.
Well, you know, I wouldn't think it would be anything negative.
No, that's right. I don't know really what I'm trying to guess at.
Yeah, well, this I've sort of been very quiet here, trying to draw yourself out.
I just always think about that picture. I don't know why. It's just a picture of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, a guard and a gun, and I just go, wow.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there are. It's just like in the Buddha's day. There were soldiers with weapons. You know, so that hasn't changed. And many times, like if you need to be guarded from others who wish to do you harm, you need a guard with a weapon. Now, if you're the one being protected, you can have good thoughts towards the person who's guarding you, but also great thoughts towards those who try to harm you. Because you know those who are trying to harm you are actually driven by disturbing emotions and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's no problem from the point of view of the person being guarded and how you could look at it. But the person who's doing the guarding, it's tricky, isn't it? Because you might have to take a life, but it would be for a greater purpose. Or you might have to lose your life. Now, you might have to give your life up to protect someone, or you might have to take a life.
Mm.
And when one takes the life, it doesn't have to be out of anger, fear, or anything like that. Do you remember the story of when the Buddha himself was the bodhisattva on the ship?
Yeah.
Yeah, that story is to demonstrate. Of course, if there was anything else you could have done that would have prevented that activity, that would have happened. But I think the story is trying to point out that even taking a life can be done in a particular way where it doesn't, you don't have to do it out of hatred or anger or fear or anything like that.
Okay.
And, and as regards to, what His Holiness might be thinking, we don't even know what one another is thinking, and we're rarely even aware of what we are thinking. It just sort of comes up, a lot of it. So, especially in relationship to His Holiness and so forth, we anyone we think of as enlightened, we're always guessing, and if we're going to do that, we might as well guess on the positive side of it, but it's good for us.
And also on that photo, I remember that photo. It's so amazing because It's the one from the back of His Holiness, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And he's just touching the guard, and there's such incredible tenderness just in the body language of the hand captured in that photo.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you just by looking at that photograph, you can actually feel that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, for me anyway, I can feel it.
Yeah. Do you have any other comments, Sibifi, that you'd like to share, or does anybody else like to say anything?
Adi, if I can make just one point, though, it's to do with the point about what might be harmful at present but not in the future. And there's a lot of very brave, noble people who rescue people from torture, potential beheadings, and all of the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think of the Panchen Lama who disappeared when the Chinese took over, you know, there might be harmful conflict to get him back, but in the future that would be very positive, for example. So it's really complex points.
Yeah, you know, from our perspective, we don't have we don't know the future. So this is why it's really important to we don't know the future outcomes of any of our actions. We can surmise and we can look along with the Buddhist teachings and so forth. Right? But, you know, we can't say if you do something good, it's definite that something good will come out of it. If you go like, why not? You say, because you can interrupt it with anger. There's lots of things that can interrupt the result of something. Mm. So we need to be... you know, awake and open, and open to that. So when we do act, we try and act with this bodhisattva attitude. We have this intention that whatever we do, it will bring about the welfare of all beings. And that will produce, you know, our own enlightenment. We will become enlightened for their benefit.
So, Eddie, there's an example, you know, like when people do an intervention with someone, you know, with an addict of some sort, and the whole family gets together and does an intervention. So that's another of those things. It's incredibly traumatic, and it really depends on the positive motivation of those family members. And, you know, and it's a terrible experience for the person who's the addict. But it's, you know, it's to save their life.
Yeah. So that's very, you know, once again, important that, you know, if we do something like that, because it could well be, as it could be our children that find themselves in cults or find themselves addicted, or our children's children. Right? And so we need to I'm just kind of let it go. We have to act on it. So then it's, how skillful can, you know, we need to be skillful in our act. But even before the skill, there has to be this intention to bring about, you know, this big result of the perfections of enlightenment. And, you know, of course, even, you know, as we know, rescuing our own children or the children of others with a good intention, the person might turn around and kill themselves shortly after because they didn't want that. You know, they're so deluded. And then we could blame ourselves for something like that too, but that would be unskillful too. In other words, that was not, our intention was not for them to end their lives. Our intention was for them to have a better life. So what I'm suggesting here is that we need to really look at why we are doing things and try to bring to that why the intention to produce enlightenment for the benefit of others. Then act as best we can and know that that you know, the great welfare that we wish for others is dependent upon them. They need to do something too. Just our wish for it won't produce it. But we need to have that as our starting point. Does anybody else like to add anything to our conversation? Okay, I'm going to go back now to the other screen. Yeah, so we should, don't put your body in the service of others if you know it's going to harm that person. If you know that what they want to do with it is to harm others, then you will know it will harm this person also. And that's why often, I think His Holiness has said, it says in the text anyway, that, those people who, for instance, like this war one, right? So a man goes out and commits, kills somebody, or a number of young men go out and kill a number of people and perhaps die themselves. The person who ordered them to do that, the karma is much, much greater on that person than those who took the life. So we need to remember that when others give us instruction that will take the life of another, that person is also responsible for the loss of that life. So I often see these shows, and actually it's going on in America right now, where there's a number of different people on death row, and their sentences have been like sped up. It's like, come on, let's get it over. Let's just kill them. Kill them now. And then you bring other people in to like be a witness to it. And some people are asked to come in. So the people who give those types of orders, when they do it and you participate in that act, they're actually contributing to them have this negative karma of killing.
Eddie, doesn't that depend though on the motivation? Because some people...
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It could be. It could be like, I will go rather than have somebody else do it who has no spiritual skill.
Because, I've heard of people going and witnessing those executions to be somebody there for the person being killed, which is quite different from people going to witness the execution out of revenge.
Yeah, but either way, you contribute to that person who made the order, isn't it? You're offering up your time, your body, your awareness, so this person can make the order to carry out the killing.
Right.
You're contributing to their negative karma. So this is what it's sort of saying. Don't enable others to harm themselves. So in brief, so we've come to the end of our class. We looked at the things to give, and we've looked at it sort of brief, and this is the detail one we've just looked at.
Eddie, you're finishing half an hour early.
It's just the way it is. I've got nothing more to say because you've been more half an hour off. And like I said, in this presentation now, we're not going through like we did before, just more and more and more and filling up 2 hours. I want to give you enough and enough space to actually think about each topic as we go through. So sometimes we will finish earlier. Other times we'll finish on time.
So that's a hint for everybody that if you have any questions, speak now.
Yeah, otherwise, you've got enough to think about, enough to read about. This is what we looked at today.
So Rosemary's asking, about this execution thing. So what about being there for the victim so that their state of mind at their time of death is better?
That's great for the victim, but still, the person who ordered. You benefit for the victim, not benefit for the person who ordered you. Two different, actually three different karmic streams going on, isn't there? You yourself as the person there, the person is who's, you know, about to die, and then the person who instructed it.
So that's quite disconcerting then, because you can be there for with a positive attitude and yet you're contributing to the negative karma of the person who ordered it.
Yep.
Okay, Rosemary doesn't agree.
Yeah, we don't accumulate any negative karma. You yourself don't accumulate any negative karma. But you are a condition, aren't you?
Eddie, I don't understand what you mean by saying that you yourself don't accumulate any negative karma. If you're involved in it, surely you must get some sort of
karma. Yeah, but it's not karma accumulated.
I don't know what you mean.
This goes way back before about, you know, our discussion on karma, so I don't...
It's karma done but not accumulated.
That's right. There's a karma done but it's not accumulated. Not by you.
So if I see a cockroach in the kitchen, and I don't want to kill it, but I say to Willie, there's a cockroach, go and get rid of it.
Okay, now it's accumulated. It's not done by you, but it's accumulated by you.
All right, so do I get heavier? Do I get the heavier?
Yeah, you get a karmic result, a negative karmic result. You've ordered somebody else to kill. And this is why, you know, we have about the whole meat topic, isn't it? You know, people say, oh, if you eat meat, that's a negative karma. No, it isn't.
Because there's
no karma accumulated. You haven't taken the life of anything.
Oh, right. So, right?
You've eaten meat.
Because people often say that to me, you're a Buddhist, why are you eating meat?
Yeah. So you can give a lot of reasons for that.
Well, for health-wise.
Yeah, that's holiness, right. One. That's right.
His holiness eats meat health.
That's yeah, right. But if, remember, Jeanette, if his holiness only eats meat if it's already there, and if he finds out, like what happened with Geshe Tashi Tsering one time at Chenrezi Institute, when he found out people ordered the meat to be able to cook him something for his health, then he flat out refused, and that was it. He said no more meat ever again.
For his health, he even refused it for his health.
Because remember, karma is about the intention. And so if the meat's already there, so His Holiness the Dalai Lama, if he's staying in a hotel and there's already meat there on the menu, then he'll eat meat. But if he finds out that they make it a special dish for him, he won't do it, because now there's intention there, and that flat out no way.
Well, I remember reading something.
Carolyn?
Sorry.
I remember hearing about, am I unmuted?
Yes.
No.
All right. Yeah, I remember hearing about that, and the issue is that there's the direct relationship between you and the death of an animal, and that's where the issue is. So when they were ordering a specific animal to be killed to present it for his health, because it was, specially kind of hand-reared or something like that, and it had only healthy organic food, so that's the real issue. It's people like who fish, you know, there's a direct, so if I'm very careful with friends of mine who, go fishing, I never eat, like I hardly ever eat fish, but I never eat the fish that they've caught specifically then to feed their friends. That sort of, so it's that sort of relationship.
Oh, that makes me feel really worried, because I've got a husband that fishes all the time, non-stop, and yes, I do eat the fish that he catches. Now I'm worried.
Yeah. Because his intent is for to kill something to feed specific people.
Yes.
So it is an issue, I'm sorry to say, I heard explained.
Yeah. So at the same time, so you have to remember here, from your side, Jeanette, you do not have the full karmic weight of the death of that animal on you.
No, that's right.
So, like you said, so yep, there's some aspect of karma involved, but it's not the full. You will not get the full result of that karma. Because you know, like you're saying, all parts of the action of killing are not there for you.
Yeah.
That's why, you know, we do purification practices. That's the point of them. So if you look at all of dharmas as purification, accumulating merit. So if you do that, no problem. You don't need to.
And also, add any when more before you. Yeah, and you bless the food before you eat anything, as you know, as the practice. So, you know, there's a specific blessing then that that fish will get from your intent of blessing. So, you know, you can you can think in that way.
Yeah, that we you know, we are to bless the meat. Yeah, there's also different mantras for you know, blessing the corpses of beings and so forth.
So, Eddie, then going back to the thing with the executioner, so if I go and witness an execution to be the support for the criminal being killed.
Sure, yeah.
So I've got a positive motivation, but is it because I am participating in that system that then it contributes to, you know, the guard who's doing it to his negative karma? Like the more people that are there witnessing, then the more negative karma he makes?
Well, if he's ordered them to come along.
Well, I think you've got to have X amount of people. You can't have any more. So, you know, 10 people show up. So then he gets the karma of those 10 people showing up.
But it could also, you know, so of course he creates negative karma.
So even if our motivation is good, because it's subscribing to this system that is...
Well, look at the life of the Buddha and his nephew, this guy, right? So he's a fully awakened being, not someone like us, but a fully awakened being. This person creates all this need of karma. Like whenever he shows up to the Buddha and the Buddha's teaching is Sangha, this person has got this really negative attitude about it. So he cops the result of that. He ends up in the hell realms. Why? The condition is Buddha. He hates the Buddha. He thinks he's a fake. That's a condition for this bloke to really do himself a great deal of harm. And he did. So you know, if that happens with a fully enlightened being, you've got to expect it to happen with us. I mean, this is, you know, what I find one of the great things when you read the different stories of the Buddha is to remember, okay, he's an enlightened being. Here's the story, what happens to them. I'm not an enlightened being. It's got to be the same or worse. Yeah, there's also that story of the man who was building the stupa. Right? So a stupa is like a holy reliquary. So all the way, like, he was really cranky about it. He didn't like the build. He had all these wrong ideas about building and all sorts of things like that. So that's, you know, all karma being generated all the time. He's building the stupa. But when it was finally finished, he looked at it and he said he liked it. So he donated a bell for it. So when he was reborn in another life as a human being, he was an ugly, deformed human being. But he had this wonderful voice. So the ugliness of the human being was all the crankiness that he developed while they were building that stupa. The stupa was the condition. Because it's horrible result, really ugly body as a human, but this wonderful, clear, lovely voice for Dharma. So you get these mixed results. Yeah, so the thing is not, when you're Yeah, so this is interesting, isn't it? So we have these things called causes and conditions. Now, because causes and because nothing exists inherently, because there isn't anything that exists in its own right. A cause does not exist in its own right, then, and neither does a condition. So that means, from the perspective of someone else, a cause, what we call a cause, can be a condition. And what's a condition can be a cause. Right? So in these instances, we are the condition. We're not the cause of this stuff, but yeah, there's also sometimes when they describe conditions, they also call them a specific type of cause. But the substantial cause of things is to do with the mind. Right? So from the other person's perspective, we are a condition that can trigger the substantial causes of virtue or non-virtue. We're an external condition. Yeah. It depends upon that condition. You know, this often happens, isn't it? Some people hate us, some people like us. But we're just a condition for that. What's really going on from the person's point of view is, what are the substantial causes and what are the mental conditions triggering that hatred, for instance?
So then it really, Eddie, it really makes it so, it points out how crucial it is that we set our motivation in the morning, yeah, so that if we are wandering around being all these conditions for all these people around us, that at least it's got this positive direction to it. Mm. Otherwise, we're just contributing to everybody else making terrible karma.
Yeah. But like I said, I remember from the, when you look at the story of the Buddha and his nephew, right? So here is, like I said, a fully enlightened being. So so for all the other Sangha members, he's a condition that kicks off their virtue. They have great faith in him. They practice the Dharma and so forth. Here's another fella dressed up just like them, also called a Sangha member, but he doesn't have any faith in Buddha. So his result is terrible lower realm rebirth, and the other people, you know, something that's not that. So then we have a person, a highly enlightened, the enlightened being, as a condition. So that being the case for him, it's the same for us. You know? And what we should try and do is become more and more like Buddha, so that we act as a condition for more and more people to have faith in us, rather than the opposite. Yeah, but like I said, it's not the case that if you're a fully awakened being, that everybody loves you or will do what you ask them to, and like you. They won't. You know, so you have instances, for instance, like the relationship between the Buddha and his nephew. We also have the great story of the Christ in the Christian religion, where they strung up on a cross.
And Eddie, what about all those Shugden practitioners that are really against His Holiness? Because I was at, when I was back in Britain, on holiday, there was a conference in Nottingham, so I went down to it. And those people were really vocal outside the Nottingham Arena.
Yeah.
But His Holiness says, someone asked him about them, what do you think? He says, I feel sorry for them because they shout so loudly, they must have sore throats.
Yeah. That was his answer. Yeah, that's right. So we get another instance of this life, don't we? But, we can sort of, some of the things to take from that is like, wow, even with His Holiness, there are a lot of people that don't see Him in a good light.
Yeah.
We have the instance, like I said, the story of the Buddha, same thing again. And it's the same with us. So we're just conditions for the other's disciplined or undisciplined states of mind that will produce either suffering or happiness for them. And others are the same for us. You know, and that's why you see in this training here, we're trying to see all sentient beings as spiritual friends. And so from that point of view, we don't create anything negative like that. Now, Jeanette, you were to say?
I wanted to say that that experience, I think I created a lot of negative karma for myself because they were giving out leaflets. So I said to one of the girls, right, I'll have a read at it. And I read it that night and I just didn't like what they were saying in it. And I was a bit vocal to one of the girls the next morning, a bit angry that she was showing all this anger towards His Holiness.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose I said to them some things that I shouldn't have said. Yeah. But it's hard to control yourself when you get faced with something like that. Yeah. They're saying so many things about the person that I sort of look up to, the person that I, every time I make a decision or something, I always say, what would His Holiness do? And they're sort of ridiculing him. And made me very angry.
Yeah, for sure. Actually, that reminds me of another story where in the Buddhist time, so oftentimes, you know, just like with all human beings together, whether you're like us, lay people, or with Sangha, disagreements arise. And, you know, in the story, the kings, of course, have given, you know, the Buddha a big parkland so that he could, you know, the Sangha could abide there during, I think, the monsoon seasons. And they stop there and they meditate and take teachings and things like that. So while they were in this park, there was the Sangha are sort of, they're not all in one place, but groups of them all over the place. So one group, the Sangha, were very argumentative with one another. So then the Buddha goes there and points out the faults of argumentation and encourages them to coexist with one another peacefully. Well, they won't have a bar of it. So they keep arguing with him, you know, and this and that and blah, blah, blah. So what does he do? He leaves. He leaves them there and he goes off and joins another group of Sangha. And his thing was, this is, there's no point in me being here. I'm just like a condition for them to get even more upset. They're not open to listening. Whereas this other group of people are. So that's where I'll go. It's more beneficial if I go over there. So for me, I like these stories because they're about an enlightened being.
Mm-hmm.
And their lives can actually be pointers for how we should live. And also, you know, if the Buddha can do that, surely we can too. We could go, gee, I'm not even enlightened. I can't help them a great deal here. I think I'd maybe just keep my mouth shut, wish them well and go somewhere else.
Yeah, I was amazed when His Holiness said that. He felt sorry for them. And then he laughed. I thought, gosh, if somebody was directing so much anger towards me, I don't think I could handle it like that.
Yeah, well, at present, that's the case for most of us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Eddie, on as recently as Friday, as in my son's going for physio, and it's a 2.5-hour session because it's a recovery gym session. And anyway, I decided to take a walk, and it's in the Spring Hill area. And I walked along Leichhardt Street. And for the first time I saw it said Kadampa Meditation Center.
Sure.
And I went, well, my initial response, because I was completely unaware, was, oh, look at that. But it was the most, so I'm neutral. I don't know what the center is. But I had this described as like a dark feeling deep in my heart at my really level. And then when I went over there, I realized it was a Shugden practice center.
Yeah.
So even before, as I was walking there, there was something deeply inherent that I knew it just wasn't quite right. And I just thought I'd share that. I can't describe the feeling where it came from, but it was a genuine feeling. And then I just turned and then I just walked on with again, a neutral attitude towards it.
Yeah,
because His Holiness, Lama Zopa Rinpoche said about the Shugden practice in particular, which is not a Buddhist practice, but is, you know, purported to be, that it's very sticky, that it's like oil that gets into cloth and just spreads and spreads. So it's a real tragedy that the the people that are involved, you know, on one hand, they're attracted to Dharma, to Buddhism, but without enough merit, they meet a not a fully qualified path, a path that's, you know, got this non-Buddhist practice with it. And it's so sticky that it's like, it's so difficult to get out of. So, I mean, just kind of thinking about that, every now and again, we'll get someone here who will come from having been involved with that group for a while. And then, you know, pretty much it's when they'll say bad things about His Holiness that people start feeling really uncomfortable and be incredibly distressed, because here you are thinking that there is a Buddhist group, you know, and all Buddhists are good and whatever, and then suddenly there's all this infighting and everything. So really this close to losing their faith, it's a really distressing kind of thing. So I kind of think of that when I look at the group like that, that it's made up of people that are, circumstances have ripened for them that's made it very, very sticky for them, so difficult to get out of. Someone was saying something?
So once again, Chris, can you hear me, Chris? Yeah. Okay, so...
Yes, Eddie.
Yeah. So once again, like I said, when you get these feelings, like, it's like I said, you know, you can go, there's a couple of things you can do. You can go to neutrality and leave it there, or you can become neutral and then go virtuous again. And the way to go virtuous is to do the giving and taking. It's the simplest, real fast way. It's like, you know, those feelings, which is like, now I've got something to work with. Now I can be compassionate. Now I can generate love. So it's like they are like, you know, Rabina says, you know, it's like they're the fuel. Before, in the lower stages of practice, they're problematic. We need to push them aside and replace them with the opposites. Here, they're not problems at all. They're fuel for the development of our love and compassion. But, you know, you can only do what you can remember to do and where you're up to. The thing is to try not to create any more negative stuff.
Yes, I know exactly what you're saying, and it's been a practice for me, because where that centre is in Leichhardt Street and Upper Edward there is where I drive by at least, 5, 6, 7 times a week for various things. And when I first saw it, it was like a stab in the heart.
Yeah.
And then I just said, well, no, I have to continue my normal drive around. And so it became a practice. And yeah, Now I can drive past it with equanimity. At least a level of equanimity. But it's also encouraging to know that just two streets around the corner is where Geshe Tassi Sering has his rooms, and he's aware of their location, and he is completely, complete equanimity himself and compassion towards them, because I asked the nuns once, did he know that they're there? And they said, yes. That's fine, and he just sort of practices compassion and equanimity.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, we do what you're capable of. As Buddhist practitioners, our first our foundation of ethics is to do no harm. So don't harm yourself by thinking negatively about it. So, you know, bring yourself to a neutral state and then practice anything you are capable of at that time. So I keep suggesting giving and taking. That's a practice I like. You can just immediately, you've got it. You've got the suffering. You know, it's like, okay, there it is. I can be compassionate towards myself by knowing that everybody feels something like this. know, and by me having this, it can represent what everyone else feels, all that discomfort and pain, that stab. May they be free of it. Yeah. You know, we exhale with them, you know, understanding, or in this case, you know, you go to understand that they would find authentic teachers, an authentic path.
Because that's the real stab in the heart, isn't it? That someone has the inclination for the Dharma and yet, you know, just overshoots, doesn't have the merit to have unmistaken teachers. So what kind of tragedy is that?
Mm. Yeah, one of the worst tragedies, isn't it? Because, you know, there's other stories like that in the... this is what happened to Angulimala.
Angulimala, that's right.
Same thing. You know, his teacher told him that, yeah, you get lucky, you need to kill 1,000 people. And because he believed in that teacher, he had great faith in him, he was a great student, little realizing the teacher was jealous of him, he went off and started doing that. But, you know, the lovely thing about that story, too, is Angulimala met an authentic teacher and was able to change his mind. So we could also think, okay, yep, we have students there that are being misled. But because of the nature of the mind, they could discover that. They could change. That in fact, all things are changeable.
That experience in Nottingham really changed me, because I thought a lot about how I'd reacted, and I vowed to myself, if I was ever in that situation again, that I would never react the way I did with anger. I would have a different attitude altogether.
Fantastic.
Because I've thought a lot about it, I know I was completely wrong.
Yeah. So yeah, like, you know, with this, like I said before about the, if we're training in this path, we see others as our spiritual friends. You know, so then they're our teachers.
Yeah.
But people can teach you what not to do.
That's right.
How lucky you're not doing that. Or even if you are doing it, you go, oh, that's the wrong thing to do. Good to know that.
I'm sort of quite really ashamed of myself for the way I reacted to them. But I will never do it again. Never.
Yeah, there you go. That's a great thing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Okay, folks. Well, we've come to the...
So just before you finish, Eddie... So, you know, then the last time when His Holiness was here and there were those demonstrators outside the venue, the Tibetan community had this wonderful response that might bring a smile to your face, Jeanette, that they, you know, the demonstrators were on one side of the road and the Tibetan community came along and stood along the other side of the road in all their beautiful, you know, folk dress and just sung Tibetan folk songs at the top of their lungs. And so everybody, as they walked past, the demonstrators were drowned out and everybody was serenaded with these beautiful tunes as they walked in. So it's such a non-violent response.
That's wonderful.
But also, Jeanette, the things that we regret are the things that really stick with us, aren't they? So that is the mischievous ones, as His Holiness calls them, being our teacher.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, well, we'll wind it up then. Just to say thank you again for attending the classes. It's lovely having these discussions, especially about something as meaningful as the practices of the Bodhisattva. So maybe we'll be able to put these practices into our lives as quickly as possible and thereby bring about the benefits for ourselves and others that I mention so often in the texts. By doing this, may this repay the kindness of our teachers and also the kindness of all sentient beings.